So let's start just a little general and tell me about a little bit about what led you to first engage and get started in politics.
Actually, it was about 1988, and I was PTO president of the Manhattan Catholic Schools. And we got a letter from the county saying that they were going to use the playground across the street from the school to build a new jail, and that we would not be able to use it after January of 89. And that seemed kind of shocking to us. So we did a little research on the history of it, and we learned that it was gifted to the county for a park in 1955, I believe. And it always had been a park, but there was a jail on the back corner, and so they were just going to expand the jail. That jail was 60,000 square feet, and it's actually sitting, the same design is sitting out at Seth Child and Fort Riley Boulevard right now. But we didn't feel that it was an appropriate place near a church, near a school, with preschoolers, children in kindergarten through 12th grade in the building at the time. So I learned about politics, and I learned what happens in the local community when these issues come up. And I didn't know who the county commissioners were. I had never seen them. My husband came into a meeting where they were invited one night, and somebody said, "Oh, is that one of them?" And I said, "No, that's my husband." You know, so we were very naive, and we had to really work hard. And it was 12 years before the new jail was built and opened in the new space. So that's how I got started, and it was a good education on what goes on in the community, who's involved, who cares, and how they work.
There's always these competing desires within the public. Two big ones are state services, better state services, as well as keeping taxes lower. What are some thoughts on how to balance those desires from the public?
Balancing the needs of the people with the revenue is what I do every day in the Appropriations Committee. And we found out with the Brownback experiment that we went too far. I didn't support it. He actually didn't request all that he signed. I think that the legislature kind of played a game with him, and we got caught up because a lot of folks made the cuts deeper than he had recommended. I'm really not defending the man, but he didn't have to sign that bill. He should have vetoed it and sent it back to us and said, do it right. This is too hard. But we went too far, too fast, and it was at a time that we were coming out of the recession, and other states zoomed past us because they did not make such a drastic move in their tax policy. So when we did that, we actually gave 330,000 citizens the right to pay no income tax. And this isn't that big a state. What, we have 1.8 million, 2 million people. That's a good chunk of the population. Plus, it was also, the experiment actually was to give people who make all of their living directly from their tasks instead of through companies. So it was private individuals, which included a whole lot of farming and a lot of rentals, properties, and just it was amazing how far that reached into the pocketbook of the state. And our research staff gave us the information that we needed to vote no, and I voted no. But a lot of people thought, well, he won't sign it, but he did. So how we balance the needs, that's what we're doing now, is coming back into a better tax plan. We have revenues that we can actually look at the needs. I spent yesterday in a corrections committee, oversight committee meeting. We're talking about the needs of the Department of Corrections, and it actually came up that we had taken money from Corrections Department to pay for our crisis intervention centers for mental health, and it was actually a maneuver that most of us didn't know about. So that's, we were talking most of the day about how do we balance this. And so the Corrections Department has lots of mental health needs. I thought that this money was coming out of the state general fund. And so it was changed in the conference committee. No one in the room knew it until yesterday. So it's like We have to balance those needs every day. We cut $500,000 out of our budget every year after Brownback put those tax cuts through, and that is a heck of a lot of cuts. So now what we need to do is set our priorities and see where the biggest losses were and try to restore those. And education was one of those big losers. Higher education was a horrible loser, $34 million cut, and maybe $15 million of it restored. That is just too much. And we see it in our enrollment. We have people not coming to school here. We don't know exactly what all the reasons are, but education has just gotten so pricey. What that does is it makes education unavailable to people who need it the most, because their families need to get out of poverty, and we want them to be able to earn their way out of that. Students have a lot of debt, and that's crazy. It's more debt than their house payment.
This kind of piggybacks off of that as well. Now that revenue seems to be rebounding to a degree, or at least rising, maybe not fully rebounding, but there's been talks again of lowering taxes now. Do you think this is the right time for that?
I would really like to see us do no harm, and I'd like to see us go at least another year to see what our revenues do. We weren't certain about what the federal tax cuts were going to do the state of Kansas, and our research people are still unsure what that's going to do. I think they probably are coming up with an answer, but November 10th is our consensus revenue estimating day, and I'm really anxious to hear what they say. We don't have to go back and fund everything that was totally funded in the past. There have been a lot of changes in efficiencies, and goodness, Brownback did away with 2,000 state employees. So our costs will be down. We need to hire people in certain areas, but in other areas, maybe we found efficiencies. And so I'm willing to look at it from both sides.
And sort of continuing on the tax talks, there's been some talks amongst people in local government, maybe expressions of displeasure regarding the tax lid. And now there's also discussions, or Kobach has been talking a little bit about possibly instituting a cap on property valuation increases. Do you think state government should have a say or a hand in sort of these dealings that are typically left to local government?
Well, no, I don't. I think local officials are the ones who need to know how to make the decisions locally. Serving on the local government and watching even the jail process, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into all these decisions. It's not just, hey, let's do this. Okay. You know, there's a lot of work, a lot of study. The city and county staff do a lot of work. The local officials do a lot of work. And they're the ones who really know what we need. However, I think what happened in the tax lid was it was an attempt by Governor Brownback to not shift all of our state changes to local government by capping it. And I didn't agree with him doing it, but I did see what he was trying to accomplish was we were cutting state spending, and that means support for our local highways and streets, safety enhancement projects, and all those things that communities expected and wanted to get and wanted and needed. So he was saying, you know, well, we cut our spending and you don't need to pick it up. You need to keep your spending down. But I think it was too far reaching. It wasn't his job. It wasn't our job to curtail local spending.
There's also been talks in this all across the board, numerous different candidates talking about term limits for state legislation, be it the Senate or the House of Representatives. What are your thoughts on the concept of term limits in the state house?
I know from going to national conferences and around the country, a lot of states do that. I don't know where you would put the limit, and I don't know that I support it, although my husband always said, you know, people will get rid of you when they're sick of you, and I think that is true. And I think what is important is that we have some knowledge of what's going on in the state. It's like I told you about the Corrections Committee meeting. I've been involved in that, and something happened, and I watched every minute of the Conference Committee report, so I don't know where that happened, and I'm going to find out. you've got to have some continuity and some historical knowledge. So if we do that, we need to stagger it. I don't know how that would be done, maybe by lottery, but we need to stagger it so that there be people around that have the institutional memory. And then when you go through a time like with recent, with Governor Brownback getting rid of 2,000 state employees, then what do you have? You don't have any you don't have any historical perspective on your paid staff. And that's what, you know, I'm not comfortable with short-time term limits. If they were 10 years or 12 years maybe, that would give you time to make a difference for your community and for your part of the government.
This might be a little bit of a two-part question. You've already touched a little bit on your thoughts on the state of education in the state. So I guess I might just touch more on the other side of that two-part question, which is there has been talk about sort of removing the Supreme Court's role in determining what is adequate funding for education. That would, of course, require a constitutional amendment to do that. Do you think that's a good way to go?
I think it's interesting how you said that, because how can we remove the court's role from our lives? You know, and I have a strong feeling that the courts are a really important part of our government, and that is why we really work hard to make our laws just. And we try very hard to write laws that are going to serve the people. But if a citizen or a group decides to challenge our laws, the court is the decision maker. And I can't imagine, as a citizen, if I wanted to bring suit against the state for school funding or any other purpose, that the courts would not be available to me as a citizen to do that. So, no, I would not support it.
From the latest numbers I've seen, it's somewhere around 150,000 Kansans are in that gap between being able to qualify for CanCare and being able to get the qualify for subsidized insurance premiums under the Affordable Care Act. And then sort of a mitigation of that would have been Medicaid expansion. And I understand the legislature did pass that in 2017, only for it to be vetoed by Sam Brownback. Do you think it's time to revisit Medicaid expansion in the state?
Definitely. I think we definitely need to visit how we provide Medicaid to the state. I think privatizing Medicaid was a real mistake. A lot of people cannot get accepted on Medicaid. They throw back applications. They throw back bills. They say you don't have this information or that information, and the people send it in, and then they lose it, and then they still, the providers don't get paid. You know, it is too bulky. It's too cumbersome. But yes, we have 150,000 people that make too much money for Medicaid, but not enough money to afford to buy insurance on the affordable care market. And expanding Medicaid was established so that we could fill that gap with federal support. The reason we do it is for people's health, so that people can spend some time being part of a family instead of working three or four jobs. I have friends that I know their kids are not making enough money to support family time. You know, it's just taking everything they can. Every minute of their day is working somewhere, two or three jobs at minimum wage, trying to make it work. And they make just a little too much money to qualify, but they don't make enough money to live unless they do that. So $6,000 is the per person, you know, you can make $6,000 or less in a year, and then you can qualify for Medicaid. So, and if they, you know, there's just no wiggle room for people. But what it does do is it creates about 3,800 new jobs, and it will provide stability for our healthcare institutions, like our hospitals. We can afford to give people care. We're already paying it in the private market. When I go to the emergency room and it's a 3 or 4 hour wait and I get a huge bill for it, I'm paying for the ones that are there who don't have any care, any health care.
And sort of also continuing on sort of a health care discussion, there's talk about privatizing Osawatomie State Hospital, the mental hospital there. Do you think privatization is a good way to address some of the deficiencies maybe in the mental health system in the state, if that's a good way to describe it?
There's been a lot of discussion about that in my appropriations committee work. There is not the will on that committee at this time to privatize mental health services in Kansas, and it has to come out of a committee somewhere that approves the financing of the facility. There's a lot of red tape, and we got shut down by the federal government because we didn't comply. Goodness sakes, there's rules. And if we weren't going to comply, then our people were at risk. My personal opinion on that is, if we're going to incarcerate someone, whether it be a prison or a mental health facility, you know, a lot of people are taken against their will to a mental health facility for time being, time out time, to recoup and stabilize. If we're going to make those decisions about people's lives, then I think we as a state need to be responsible for those people, totally.
And I've jumped around for a few different topics here, but at the end, I kind of want to turn it over to you. This is how I've been ending most of the interviews here. What are some of the issues, concerns, or just general topics that you think are most important going into your upcoming election, or just going forward in general?
One of the things I want to see is restore trust in government. People that I represent trust me, and I don't have that problem, but I work with it every day where we might not trust each other, our comrades or colleagues in the legislature. We have to learn to trust each other. We have to learn to trust our judgment, and we have to be sure that we elect people that have the state's good health at heart and not their own personal gains. I think that is the biggest thing that government and our democracy is facing right now, is the divisiveness, and I don't, it's not up to just anyone, but all of us, to regain that confidence. Other than that, as an elected official, I'm going to be voting on budgets. I'm going to be voting on agriculture is my area to work mostly with in the Capitol. I work with 14 area agency budgets in the budget committee, where I'm the ranking Democrat, and also I'm the ranking Democrat on ag committee. So I've been focusing on ag issues. Not a lot the state can do about prices in agriculture, but we can let the president know that the tariffs have been a problem for us and that it's hurting our state and our farmers' pocketbooks. And we do that through resolutions. We send resolutions to Congress saying, you know, please do something about these things, and they probably ignore them, but we do take a stand. I think it's important that we get our balance in our budget, and we're setting priorities about where the needs are the greatest. And we also need to take care of our internet sales tax, and there were some issues that need to be resolved at the state level before we can do that. And I think that the tax department is trying to decide what we need to do legally to make this happen for Kansas. And there's some talk that the federal government may do something, but they're very, very slow to act on internet anything. And I think the states are just going to have to step up and do the work. The federal government, after 25 states or so get their act together, then they'll probably pass what we need. We have a lot of foster care issues. I think they're being worked on, but I talked with someone in the Department of Children and Families this week, and it seems like they're still concerned about, there's so many runaway kids. But why are they running away? I don't know. And I guess that's something I'm not an expert on. I understand there are kids that just have always been runaways and they're always going to run. But we have to know where they are, and we need to have our foster care families need to be supported by the state in such a way that they can afford and are willing to taught how to love these kids and keep them safe. And it takes an investment by the system. And I think that in privatizing foster care, we lost that because somebody has to make some money. And if they're going to be an agency that's dependent on making a profit, they're going to have to find ways to cut corners. And one of the things that's happened over the years is children are moved from one home to another simply because they get more money when they move them. So things like this just need to stop. We've got to start acting like grown-ups.
Sydney, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, you're welcome.